Greetings and salutations. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada. You are listening to a matinee cast presentation of Playing Favorites. This is the final volume, volume 3. Here's the skinny. I'm taking a much needed break and headed on a much anticipated adventure, and I must say I am very much excited to be doing both of these things. However, it doesn't mean that our little conversations need to stop. In fact, it all got me thinking about this show and how often we talk about films before a lot of you fine folks get to see them. I wanted to revisit some of these. I wanted to revisit some of my favorite films of the decade so far and revisit the conversations we had now that most of you have seen the films we chose. And we conclude today by going back to 2022, one of my favorite films of that year, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once by the Daniels. 2022 felt like cinema was ready to move forward again after being stuck in stasis for most of 2 years. We began to get a lot more new stories after making our way through The Leftovers during some real uncertainty in 2021. Of all these new stories, none felt newer to me than the springtime delight, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. The film took the chip as my favorite of that year because, and I don't say this often, the film is singular. There have been a lot of stories over the years about parallel timelines and multiverses. And Lord knows, in the age of comic book films, we are getting so many more. However, even in an age where multiversal stories are becoming more and more common, this film, this one story about so many stories, it stands alone. It's a film that speaks to the delicate relationships between parents and children, and to the tender complexities of marriage. It speaks the language of both Pixar and Wong Kar-wai. It underscores the real beauty of a life spent doing laundry and taxes. The film is one of a kind, and it would win the Oscar for Best Picture of 2022. We talked about that film on MatineeCast 282 with Coria Tad, longtime friend of the show, and a guest I always love bringing back, even if he is often wrong. So let's get into it. Playing Favorites, Volume 3, my favorite film of 2022, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
This is a life.
Every possibility.
Free from destiny.
I choose you and you choose me.
Not only what we sow.
So Everything Everywhere All at Once is directed and written by the Daniels, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. It's written by those two along with... No, it's just written by those two. It stars Michelle Yeoh, Kaewi Kwan, Stephanie Hsu, James Hong, and Jamie Lee Curtis. Everything Everywhere All at Once is about, well, exactly that. See, our fixed point in time is one where Evelyn Wang, that's Michelle Yeoh, is running a failing laundromat with her husband, Waymond. That's Kaewi Kwan. They're struggling to keep their bond with their daughter, Joy, and they're also staving off an IRS auditor played by Jamie Lee Curtis. That's the constant. The variables involve a martial arts master, a top chef, a Hollywood star, and other alternate timelines that almost defy imagination. So how do we get from one to the other? Well, I'm glad you asked. You see, at the audit of their fledgling business, an alternate Wayman finds Evelyn Prime and tells her that all of existence is in peril, and it's all at the mercy of their daughter and her attempt to process her own overwhelming amount of emotion. In an everything bagel of frustration, pain, angst, garlic, and poppy seeds. No, really. So it goes that Evelyn will jump from timeline to timeline using every skill she can muster to stop her daughter from destroying the multiverse. Stories that flip timelines aren't exactly new. It's a concept that's been used by everything from H.G. Wells to Star Trek, featured everyone from Jake Gyllenhaal to Gwyneth Paltrow. It's a concept that can make a person go loopy pretty quick when one considers how many decisions they make in a day and how many alternate timelines that creates. Into this arena steps Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. A story that is both familiar and so damned unique. So pop quiz hotshot. Is this movie exactly what one thinks it will be? Or is it not at all what anyone thinks it'll be?
It's some of the things you'll think it will be and a whole lot more. You know, it's funny because as you were describing it, I was kind of going like, oh my God, is he giving away too much actually about the emotional plot threads of the movie? And then I was like, well, no, because I don't think anything can prepare you for both the depth to which it goes in those areas, and then also like the ways in which it gets there.
Yeah.
Which is like so mad that it's like, it's the kind of movie that I genuinely don't think you can spoil.
No.
Because it's not about the act of watching it, but so much about the act of watching it informs like how you take in what happens in it. That it's like, it's a lot.
It is. And I mean, I think that might be why this movie is not what it seems to be. Like, on its surface, this is a parallel timeline movie, or mm-hmm. a multiverse movie, if you want to call it that. But in reality, it's a movie that wants you to bear witness. It's a movie that just wants you to sit with somebody who you may otherwise not really pay attention to, who seems quite normal, mm-hmm. and just, you know, quite everyday. But at the same time, it's like, there is so much more than everyday contained in this person's soul, to say nothing of the way that she is refracted over time. Putting that aside, like just sitting with these people who run this laundromat, who are getting audited, whose daughter is gay and is, you know, trying to get her mother to accept that. Mm-hmm. It's just that alone is actually a charming little story before we get into what we get into. And that part, I think, is just, that part is all of the delight to really keep you in this moment of love and...
But Ryan, I mean, you know, I know what you're trying to say, and that's true. And I agree with every word. And at the same time, this is also a movie with, you know, hot dog fingers and butt plugs and rakakui. So it's like,
so what I just described is like, I just described like, what's the French movie where she peels the potatoes? Jean Delmont 23.
Yes.
I just described that. Yes. You know, I just described like the drama in the everyday, which is not what this movie is. It is kind of like,
it is
right
that.
In this, right in the center, but there's an awful lot that goes around, like around that center. The metaphor of a circle is used in this movie a lot, and it's really
apt. Quite a bit. Somebody recently pointed out to me that there's, you know, there's the running theme of the black void of a bagel consuming the universe. And then the inverse of it is the Google eyes.
Yeah.
You know, googly eyes, but she keeps calling them Google eyes. And somebody pointed out to me that visually it's actually, they're the exact inverse.
Right.
Of each other, with like the white and then the black inside. I was like, that must be intentional. That feels really, every piece of the movie kind of feels kind of considered that way. Both in how to bring, like, caveat, like, I understand this is quite a intense movie in a lot of ways, like, just not like intense stylistic, it's just like throwing stuff at you all the time. A lot of it's very, very goofy. There are, so not everyone's going to be into that, but if you're into that, it's all so considered in how to make everything both as goofy as possible and as maximalist as possible, while also being as emotionally serious as possible and thoughtful as possible. Right. I don't totally understand how they did it.
Oh no.
I mean, I've read sort of criticisms of the movie where I actually kind of agree with some of those criticisms, as like, you know, if I take a 30,000 foot view of like, particularly the last act, there's a way in which they feel the need to like, tie every little thing up and do it in this really kind of protracted way that just underlines every moment. I understand first off why that wouldn't work for people. I think it's a genuine flaw in the movie in terms of like the pace, the kind of the way that it's paced, and it is quite a long movie. Mm-hmm. And perhaps if they could have solved that problem, it might have been a shorter movie. At the same time, I was just with it that entire time. So throughout that whole last act, that like, even as I recognize that maybe it's a bit imperfect, a little bit too neat or whatever. I was like a mess. I was like an emotional wreck the whole time, just crying my eyes out and just be like, it's just like unbelievable. But I will say, I think that a movie like this allows for a certain level of imperfection because the imperfections are like, frankly, part of everything. I do.
It's funny because listening to you say that, I'm actually struck now with something that I wasn't struck by when I was like preparing for this episode, and certainly not when I sat down for the movie. I actually really believe this is the movie for these times. This is the movie for those of us who have just been a raw nerve, who are feeling everything, who are like, you know, like the anxiety is through the roof, the depression is through the roof, the stress, all of it, just 2 years into this, no end in sight. And at the same time, it's like, we want to process that and we want to see that and we want to embrace that and have that wrap its arms around us and say, it's okay. But at the same time, we want to see something nuts. You know, we don't want to just sit with more of this for 2 hours. We want it packaged with kung fu and hot dog fingers and rakakui and bagels that threaten to devoid existence. You put those things together in literally an everything bagel type of a movie. By the way, I've never been a fan of everything bagels. I just want to say that right here.
No, neither am I.
They suck.
Although, well,
pick a lane bagel. No. You can combine the flavors. There's all kinds of combinations. Okay.
First off, you're talking to a Jew here, so
you
got to have some respect. But also, what I'll say about the everything bagel is it's got too much.
Yes.
But quite frankly, if it's the only bagel you got, it's not like you're complaining.
Oh,
you
know
what I mean?
Right.
You're complaining at the store. Right. Yeah. You're like, why don't you have, but like, if somebody gives it to you, you're still like, man, this is a bagel. Yeah. It's got a whole bunch of flavors. I still like it.
I'll eat it. Yeah, that's fine. In the middle, it's fine. Just maybe scrape off the whatever seed you don't like.
Well,
you know, I mean, on the surface, this movie should be deeply sad and maybe even nihilistic, like so many timelines, so little actual meaning to any one of this. And yet the movie is actually quite joyful. How does this movie preserve the joy?
First of all, part of it is through just all that goofy humor. But I think this is something that Soraya Roberts, who wrote about the movie for Defector just this past week, and I saw it with her, the movie with her, and she was very taken with it and surprised at how taken she was with it. Because she didn't expect to like it going in. She saw the trailer and was like, this doesn't look like it'll be for me. Her write-up on the movie connected it to a couple other things, including the other recent movie, After Yang, that has some similar themes in it. And particularly this idea of how we live in the current world. Now, partly that's a pandemic thing, but it's not just a pandemic thing. I think it's notable that in interviews, Daniels, they actually don't even use the definite article.
Yeah.
they've talked about how they started writing it essentially like in the wake of Donald Trump's election. And it wasn't like a direct response to, oh no, Donald Trump is elected, as like the kinds of crazy times we're living in. And particularly you go on the internet and it's just like this endless stream. And what they wanted to do was make a movie that reflected, both the manner in which we consume media now, as well as the kind of tumultuous lives that people lead and the difficulties of connecting with people within that. I just wanted to read a little bit from what Soraya wrote.
Please.
While everything in the making of this film mattered, a theme throughout the film is that nothing matters, which actually has the unexpected effect of freeing you up to choose what you really want. For Michelle Yeoh's character, it's being with her daughter. In Daniel's conception of the world, the multiverse is what it means to be alive right now, but each individual story, like a returning chorus, vibrates within it. They just have to listen out for it. I thought that was quite movingly put, but I think that that is the answer to the question that you're asking. And it's the answer to the question, both in terms of like, how does the movie achieve its depth, but also how does it achieve its joy without being subsumed into nihilism. It's because it's a movie about how, amid all of this crap, to find yourself and to find other people has a kind of joy and meaning, and that's where you find happiness and grounding. In the end, it's a simple idea, right? Be kind to people, be generous, be kind to yourself. As I was telling another friend earlier today, some of the best works of art ever made are about exactly that. Like, you don't need to have like all these crazy philosophical ideas, which the movie also has.
Yeah.
You know, about not just the literal stuff about past universe or alternate universes and things, but like all the regrets of life and how you can stew over those. And what does it mean to get to witness those things and see what could have been, and how does that affect your present? And you know, your brain starts kind of going wild, right? But yeah, they attach such humanity to it. It's so great.
You're right. Soraya is right as well. I think for me, it preserves the joy in reminding us at really and truly, like in a time where a lot of us don't have much. Like, we have a lot, let's be honest. We have a lot, and we probably have more than we need. But, you know, compared to the amount of consumption that's out in the world, and the amount of very, very high privilege that is out in the world, most of us are just making do. Certainly most of the people listening to this show. It really actually doesn't take a lot to give you that moment of warmth. You know, that's the thing. Like, we see timelines where Evelyn is a kung fu master, where she is a Hollywood star, where she's a chef, where she's, you know, somebody who's living somewhere else but looks very, very fashionable, the way that another person in another movie looks very, very fashionable living somewhere else. And yet she has a simple life. She has reasonably low stress. She has a business of her own, and she's got somebody who she cares for that slaps googly eyes on everything because they make things look joyful. It's like, you know what, at the end of the day, that's not bad. That, you know, like that's like, you really, like, you don't need much. Like, we're in this position where we want more, and we think to ourselves, man, what would have happened if I'd gone to this school instead of this school? What would have happened if I had said no to that boy instead of saying yes? You know, like we are all, like, all of us have that fracture moment where it's like, what if? And it's like, you know what? You would have been a totally different person. Like, let's just put that flat out. Who you are would not be who you are. But you don't necessarily guarantee yourself happiness. So maybe what you have is enough, even if you're not a top chef or a kung fu master or have hot dog fingers.
And more importantly, you know, maybe certain opportunities are closed off at certain points or whatever, but the future is also unwritten. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, again, it's like these things sound trite, but they're not when presented that way, because the idea that, okay, well, maybe you weren't those things, maybe you won't even be those things in the future, but maybe you can be something that's closer to what it is that makes you actually happy. And, you know, that starts with yourself. It starts with the people around you. It starts with gestures towards people. I think it's so important that it's about connection with people. Like it's both an interior film about the things that people go through on the inside, but it's also about the ways in which people connect to each other. And it doesn't suggest that one is the solution to the other. It's simply that, you know, both kind of have to be working in tandem, right? You have to be thinking about these things and feeling them and noticing them in yourself and noticing them in others. It's really striking to me that it's a movie. Did we give like a proper plot description? I just wanted to.
As much as one can, buddy.
I'm just trying to remember what you said at the beginning in terms of the actual setup of the film and her discovery. I think we gave enough.
I got to cut you off for a quick second. I got to tell you, I went into this movie knowing nothing.
Oh my God.
Not a damn thing. Had not seen a trailer, had not read a review. Wow. I sat down and I was really tired. I sat down. I was like, I'm dreaming. There is no way I'm seeing this. There is no way this is happening.
Wow. That's, I can't even, I can't even imagine the, because I saw the trailer and it's like, look, even the trailer didn't prepare me, but it's like, yeah. You know, there's a bunch of running things in the film, including with a lot of very minor characters. Like, and again, this is what I was referring to earlier, is like almost all of them get their moment in the sun at the mm-hmm. end. Keeping it to the core family of, you know, her husband and her daughter. You know, let's start with the husband. You've got the husband who's handing her divorce papers that she's not even looking at first, until later in the film she realizes what she's been handed. The most interesting thing to me is not that he's giving her divorce papers. It's that there's a moment where he says, I forget exactly what he says, and then it's also indicated in some of the actions, that he wasn't giving her divorce papers because he wants a divorce. He's giving her divorce papers because essentially their marriage has kind of started to tear apart, mostly because she has been too preoccupied with a whole bunch of things that clearly for her have been a way of distracting herself from a lot of other, from like regrets of in her life and all kinds of other things. And so he's handing her these divorce papers more to like wake her up, yeah, so that maybe they'll have a conversation and then not get divorced. Like, which is, you know, on the one hand, a little bit, you know, wild. On the other hand, that feels real to me in the way that like, that you get into these situations where you're so trapped in your own thing, and not only trapped, but you've trapped yourself. You've like deliberately kind of created a world where you don't need to pay attention to other people.
Yeah.
And in the not paying attention to other people, you're losing that connection that's actually hurting you as well. And so the act of seeing another person and connecting with that other person, in this case, her husband, becomes a real source of healing. The same is true of her daughter, where, you know, again, Evelyn's distracted herself in all these ways, and she's not able to see her daughter, who is going through, like, I mean, literally suicidal depression. It's further compounded by the fact that the daughter is gay, which to me was one of the more interesting elements of the film, because it wasn't treated as a matter of fact thing. Part of the plot of the movie is that she kind of has to come out to her grandfather,
or would
like to, essentially, and Evelyn kind of doesn't want her to, for fear that the grandfather will have a heart attack or something, you know,
or will reject Evelyn, or will reject Joy, or will reject them both, you know, it's the old worry.
All kinds of, I mean, obviously those are the deep down worries, but I can tell you, I literally know people who have been told like, oh, don't tell your like grandmother who's like halfway out the door because it might give her a heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like literally those are things that happen in people's lives. That's an obvious part of her daughter's emotional and mental struggles. Those aren't the only part of it, right?
No.
Like
no.
It's fascinating to me that actually to some degree her being gay and being able in the movie to have a girlfriend and all of that is actually one of the few things that is keeping her grounded.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually the rest of life that she's having a problem with. You know, the movie is basically a giant metaphor for her trying to reach out to her mother, and her mother can't see it because she's so lost in her own thing. And you look at that and you go like, that's such a devastating idea, but also the beauty and understanding that like, oh wow, all it takes at some point is putting all the things aside and actually just having a human connection.
Yeah. Why do I have to threaten to destroy all of existence to get your attention?
Why do I have to do that? You know, at the moment when her mother is finally reaching out and, you know, this really, I guess, would be spoilers, but, you know, I assume people please see the movie before now, but it's like at the moment when her mother is trying to reach out and she's kind of rejecting her mother, which is again, very real in how mm-hmm. people in those situations often behave. But you also you can kind of see as a viewer, like the tension there isn't just in like, oh, is the world going to be destroyed? Oh, is something horrible going to happen to the daughter? It's, is the daughter going to realize that her mother is being genuine in this moment?
Yeah, you because know, and that's real, right? Like, yeah, like because you don't know. Is she just doing this to placate me? Is she doing this to save something else? Whether it's her grandfather, whether it's her marriage, whether it's the multiverse, you know, is the shame
of having a daughter who did such a thing? You know,
yeah, what I mean? Yeah. Is she doing it for altruistic reasons, or is she doing this for herself? Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's incredible. And,
you know, for as much as I was saying that there's a simplicity to the basic message of the movie, I think the way that it illustrates those things is actually incredibly complicated and nuanced. I think that for as much, and actually this might be, I think, why, though I agree that elements of the last act are a bit extended in ways because of how they've structured it, there are still sort of these interesting ambiguities, the most interesting of which is there's a running theme of Evelyn criticizing her daughter's weight. And at the end of the movie, she's still criticizing her daughter's weight.
Now, that's what
it's a little bit of a joke, but yes, it's what parents do. And it's not like she's a perfect person.
No.
You know? It's not like, oh, she suddenly learned to be kind and everything's like the most beautiful thing it's ever been. It's just like, oh, the being kind allows you to make connections despite those things, and maybe even to be better about those things eventually, maybe, hopefully.
You bring up the core family at the center of this movie. And I know there's been talk over the last, like, it feels like a decade now, but for quite some time about if they were to ever add an Oscar category, they should add one for casting. Because creating a perfect cast, it's not just creating an all-star movie. It's not putting together Ocean's 11, much as I adore Ocean's 11. There will be no besmirching of Ocean's 11 on this show. But it's more interesting when you get this hodgepodge of parts that all sing together so well, which you get at the core of this with Michelle Yeoh and Kaiwi Kwan and Stephanie Hsu. James Hong kind of comes and goes. He doesn't have a whole lot to do.
He's so great.
But oh yeah, every time James Hong, you could give him 2 minutes and he will make it the best 2 minutes. Yeah.
I'm just going to tell you, James Hong, I ride or die. Like, that guy's a legend.
Yeah.
That guy has been in so many different movies and TV shows. We're talking about a guy who's like done everything, but up to and including appearing in a hardcore porn film, at least one, and directing at least one softcore porn movie. So like, we're really like, this is a guy who's, you know, if there's anyone who exemplifies what movies are, it's James Hong.
Like, I mean, we're talking about him on back-to-back shows because we talked about Turning Red on the last show. So we've got, you know, it's the James Hong double feature. That would make the craziest double feature, by the way, is this movie back-to-back with Turning Red.
Some very similar themes.
A lot of them. Yeah, they would work. Yeah. I had not seen Stephanie Hsu in anything before. I am really,
I don't
really,
think I had either. What, yeah. Now that I think, what's she been in? She's fantastic.
Much. Like, if you know, you look her up, it's she was in a SpongeBob musical. I think she's a Broadway person. She's fantastic in this movie. She's absolutely incredible in this movie.
The real revelation, I think, for a lot of people is obviously going to be Kwan, because we haven't seen him in so long.
Yeah.
I think there's a bunch of things that the movie does with the cast that are so emotionally overwhelming and beautiful. One of them is obviously Michelle Yeoh and giving her not just a starring role, but this kind of role that allows her both just amazing levels of depth, as well as like letting her be funny. Like, she's talked about how excited she was to be funny and it made her scared because she wasn't sure she could be. And she is very funny in it. Of course, she also does her martial arts, which she's a pro. She's a genuine master. And so that's just so gratifying to see. You know, there's a clip going around online of one of her interviews where she literally starts crying about how, you know, when she read the part and spoke to Daniels and what this role meant for her. And it's palpable in the film. You feel it in the movie that these actors just believe in what they're making.
Yeah.
And then you've got Kwan, who represents a level of, like, I mean, you want to talk about regrets and alternate universes.
Right.
you think back to those movies that he was in, and you know, there have always been criticisms of some of the depictions in those films, you know, and in many ways, rightly so. But that's not what stopped that's not what stopped his career, because his performances in those movies are magnetic.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah, he's doing what he's doing what he's there to do. It's, you know, what he was there to do is you know, perhaps in not Temple perhaps. Yeah, it is a
short circuit.
Yeah, it is a flaw. Yeah, it is a flawed assignment, but I don't blame him for carrying out the assignment.
Yeah, and he's excellent in those as a kid, but you know, the problem is that they're kid performances, so it's a little bit difficult to judge what that means, what it would mean to deliver in this movie. The moment he appears, you're just like, okay, wait a second. Yeah. Where has this guy been?
Yeah.
Because he's so instantly charming and funny. He brings the same energy that he had as a kid, which is unbelievable because he's quite a bit older now.
Yeah.
And so you're like, how's he doing this? And then there's these moments where the level of pathos is just wafting off of him. And you're like, I didn't know. Where has this guy been? There's a whole section in the movie, a whole kind of sequence that they keep going back to that's basically done like a Wong Kar Wai film.
Yeah, I was going to say every time they go back to In the Mood for Love, buddy, you should have been doing this for the last 20 years because you are incredible. I'm like, you were made to do this. You look so bloody cool in that alley. You're so warm. You are so sexy. What, like, how have you been sitting on the bench this whole time?
It's so amazing because look, Michelle Yeoh in the movie is dressed down for sure. You know what I mean? Like
for most of it, she gets, they play her up once in a while.
No, of course. I just mean the main Evelyn, right?
Yeah. So Evelyn Prime. Yeah.
So she's like dressed down, but the thing is, we know Michelle, like we know what she can look like on screen. And so we're just like, you know, this is not the limit of it. In Kwan's case, we wouldn't have known. And so you see him show up and he looks older and whatever, but he still kind of looks goofy and he's still, you know, and you're like, okay, great. And then you see him in those sequences, which I suspect I don't know if they were like that in the script. Maybe they were. I don't know what the casting, when the casting happened. It's notable that he worked with Wong Kar Wai at one point behind the scenes on 2046.
Okay.
And so apparently was telling them stories on the set about working with Wong Kar Wai. And you know, he's had a career behind the scenes in movies.
Right. Yeah.
But to see him in that sequence and see him in that amazing looking suit and just like, you're just like, what the hell? This is a guy who could have been a leading man.
Yeah.
I mean, he still can be, but you're like, that's 2 decades at least, maybe 3, of like this guy not having gotten the kinds of roles that he could have gotten and that he clearly deserved to get. And you know, that's, in some ways, it's depressing, a depressing comment on where our culture has been. At the same time, it's so amazing to have him back. It's so like wonderful.
Well, so emblematic of this movie, right? That is the thing, is like, this movie is very much a what could have been. And you look at him, you look at Kwan in these moments and you're like, it is a tragedy that it's not, you know what? No, it's not. I'm sure he's very happy. I'm sure he's done lots of things. I'm sure he's done all kinds of, I'm sure he loves doing like conventions and that kind of thing. And he's probably very comfortable in life, but at the same time, like, you see these glimmers of what could have been. And it's like we're being greedy. You know, that's what we want. We are the person,
but he can do that now.
We're the person who's wondering, what if we went to school one, or what if we didn't date that boy? That's what we're doing now with Kwan.
Yeah.
But again, and he still can. Yeah.
That's the thing that's also encapsulated in the movie. And that's what I was getting at earlier, where it's like, okay, so there's all these things that you haven't been, but you can still be something. You can still do something. You can still be happy in some way, or in his case, like, be a goddamn movie star. You know what I mean? Like, It's gratifying. And then the rest of the cast. I mean, like,
well, I was going to say, and then in the background of all of this, we have Jamie Lee Curtis.
Jamie Lee Curtis, who has never
phoned it in her life. And she certainly is not starting here looking very frumpy, which takes some doing with Jamie Lee Curtis as this IRS agent turned operative, turned, you know, grief consortium turned, you know,
at one point romantic partner to
Evelyn. Like
with hot dog fingers,
which, I mean, that's the thing, that should be absurd, that should be like being John Malkovich level absurd, and yet the movie plays it so straight. It is absurd. It is, like, you know, it is head shakingly weird, but at the same time,
I have to say, like, let's be real. Being John Malkovich is a very good comparison point, because there's also a completely zany movie that has some real emotional depth to it and real intellectual depth to it, despite all the zaniness, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm certain that movie and that Kaufman were influences on this, the same way that obviously when you watch it, like, the Matrix is a clear influence on it. All kinds of anime as an influence, kung fu movies. It was so gratifying to me. I've always loved kung fu movies, but I love them in the way that, like, you know, they would appear on TV, and so I'd watch them every now and then. In the last kind of couple of years during the pandemic, I went through like a real Blu-ray buying spree of all these, especially in the last few years, a lot of Hong Kong movies that were previously unavailable in good quality.
Well, because what else are you doing with your money? You're at home and you can't do anything.
Totally. And what better way to spend your money than on like a bunch of Jackie Chan movies and other Hong Kong films? And it's like, you see those movies and just the boundless creativity, and part of it's wrapped up, you know, this is like a slight jag, but it relates to this movie in a way. Part of what's fascinating about a lot of those movies is that, you know, they would have kind of general scripts and general ideas, but often they were basically made up as they went along.
They were just an excuse to get the band back together, right? Like they were the old version of Ocean's 11, where it was just an excuse to get the Rat Pack into Vegas and make a movie.
Well, yeah, but it's not just that. It's that they were making movies at such a clip in the 80s and 90s that was like they literally didn't have time, including all of those famous, you know, Hong Kong, you know, the Jackie Chan fight sequences and stuff. Those were choreographed on the day.
And, sure, why not?
And what's amazing is when it's explained, I just learned this recent. I didn't know that. And I learned it recently on one of those Blu-rays and in the special features, where what they would do is they would get to the set. They had an environment. They had a bunch of ideas of things they wanted to do. And then they would basically figure out, okay, let's place the camera here and start with this sequence of moves that we can shoot. And then you'll end up here, which means we can put the camera here, and there'll be like a few more. What makes sense to do? Okay, great. Oh, and what if we did this here? And then you could do it. And that's how they did those movies, right?
It's kind of how they're doing this movie, right?
Well,
But in a more controlled setting.
In this case, more controlled setting, and they have the advantage of sort of visual effects and things like that, that you know, they can both do things that they couldn't do before, but also, you know, let's say do things safer than they used to do them. There's no blooper reel here of, like, you know, Michelle Yeoh like bashing her face in like Jackie Chan used to.
But right.
The idea of going small, and this is, you know, it's big for an indie movie, but it's $25 million movie. And the things that they're able to do in this movie by being small, but being resourceful, you know, this movie, to my mind, had as much expansiveness, even though it's actually, when you think about it, it's basically set in two places as
generally, like
in real setting terms.
Yeah.
There's like laundromat and then this IRS office that they make a lot of use of. And then there's these other places that they,
where they probably shot for like a day.
Totally.
You know, like that temple that we keep coming back to, that was probably a day's worth of shooting. The alley, the Wong Kar Wai alley, probably a day. The bamboo forest, a day. All of these things, they shot there. They're like, okay.
Like maybe not even a day.
Yeah.
And And some of
them very economical filmmaking. I love it.
Some of them you imagine were shot even literally in that IRS building or whatever, like whatever that building was. The amazing thing about it, it's so expansive. It has amazing, amazing action sequences. It has amazing visual ideas and visual effects and things like that. Visual effects done by seven people. Seven people.
Wow.
That's what Daniel Kwan was revealed on Twitter last week, I think. And not just seven people. You're not talking about like seven like of the like, you know, they got like Weta to loan out their top seven people. It's literally seven people who half of them learned what they were doing as they were doing it on YouTube, like through YouTube videos.
That's incredible.
So and like, you know, not to like bash Marvel, and funny enough, like the Russo brothers are producers on this film. I'm sorry, it looks better than just about any Marvel movie I've ever seen in terms of the integration of the world and the effects and the ideas behind those effects, right? Like, it's not that literally the CGI is better.
It's just, but here's, is so
strong, and you see the resourcefulness as part of that. You feel it in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, but here's the thing. We're having this discussion. Part of me thought for a split second there of maybe I'll excise this out, but part of me actually wants to have this moment on this show is, listen, I'm as big a Marvel fan as it gets. Love them. Go see them every, you know, whatever, 2-3 months that they come out. What I love about a movie like this is I would much rather build this movie up than use it as a reason to smack Marvel around, because Marvel doesn't need our conversation. It's going to make its money no matter what. I would rather, you know, stoke this movie up and talk about this in ways that people aren't going to come to it than talk about like,
don't get me wrong about that. Like, look, I mean, even as critics kind of bashed it, I liked Spider-Man No Way Home, and I'm like not a Marvel fan.
Right.
Okay. But like what I think is important, and I think it's important to mention Marvel here and other big blockbusters like the Marvel films. There's certain blockbusters that are not like the Marvel films, but you know, the movies that are like the Marvel films, the problems that they have in this specific respect have to do with the nature of making films where the making of them is what amounts to a purely commercial endeavor, regardless of what the artists are doing, right? You know, there's a video, quite eye-opening video that you can look up on YouTube with a visual effects guy on Spider-Man No Way Home talking about how they did the visual effects for this one particular sequence and a couple others. And, you know, a lot of it is amazing in terms of like the technology that's employed, and clearly these people are dedicated to their craft and they're doing amazing, amazing work in many respects. Although I think in many cases it doesn't end up looking great, but that's a different issue. The thing that struck me watching that visual effects breakdown is you see the way that they shoot a sequence that clearly is dictated by the fact that Marvel operates top down from a corporate angle. So rather than shooting a sequence where you're coming to the set and really getting creative and really figuring out, like those old Hong Kong movies, okay, how can we do this and look, make it just look as great as it can look, you know? Instead of doing that, they shoot a sequence where everything is flatly lit, where you have a whole bunch of stuff, where you can shoot from any angle, and then later you can kind of put it all together and make it work to the point where literally every single shot in the movie ends up having some kind of digital adjustment, because that's how it works. Now, again, that's not an issue of bashing the movie, but I think it's interesting to look at a movie like this then in contrast that shows what you can do. And this is just with $25 million. Imagine if you approached with the same mindset that this movie did, a movie with $200 million at their disposal. Like, imagine the Daniels making a movie for $200 million.
Oh, I know. I get it. And the thing is that it's one of those things where I feel like we've gotten so consumed with how these things are made and how that feels inherently bad that it reminds me of the year that Beck won the Grammy for album of the year, and he won over Beyonce.
Nice one. I love your music.
And one of the arguments was, look, everybody, all of the songs on Beck's record were written by one guy with one guitar, and he produced it with one other guy. And look at that. Beyonce's record took 25 songwriters and producers. And I'm like, you know what? At the end of the day, it's fucking Beyonce. Shut up. Sit down. It's a masterpiece too. There is room for both.
Okay. Let us do get back to Everything Everywhere. That's where I look at a movie like Everything Everywhere. And I say, there's an opportunity here. I am right now in this context bashing Marvel. When I recommended it to my friends who are the types of friends who don't listen to a podcast like this, I wasn't bashing Marvel. Right. What I was saying was, hey, this is a movie that like feels a lot like it has the things that Marvel movies have, but it also has this and this and this and this, right? And what was impressive was because I could have that hook, because it has things like multiple universes and kung fu fights and stuff like that, I was able to get those friends excited about this movie. I was able to say, like, there's a whole thing in the movie with like a reference to Ratatouille, but it's a raccoon. And they were like, what? Yeah. And they want to go see the movie. And I'm like, okay, there's a bridge. This is a movie that like in an ideal universe, you know, not that it's going to solve all of cinema's problems, but it's the kind of starting point where you can get people to say like, I know you want to see Doctor Strange that's coming out in a month or whenever it's coming out. Is it this month? I don't even know.
It's a few weeks, but time is a flat circle these days. 4 weeks, I think. 3 weeks.
They can go see that. It'll be great. Sam Raimi, excellent. But also go see this.
Yeah.
Take the time out of your day. If you're feeling okay, if you feel okay to risk it for Doctor Strange, risk it for this movie.
I do agree with you on that.
And that's so important to me. It's so important to me because I see the state of cinema. As somebody who watches a lot of movies, I'm drowning in stuff to watch. I'm drowning in it. On that level, I'm not actually worried about movies. But where I worry is in the audience connection to it. I worry about the fact that increasingly I'm watching movies that feel like movies that used to be the types that other people would watch. And now I talk to them to my friends about them, and they A, haven't seen them, and B, their eyes glaze over the moment that they understand that it's not some big blockbuster. And it's depressing. I don't want to be alone in the world. I want to be like Evelyn, making connections to everyone.
Yeah, I do hear you. But I think it's a larger conversation than it is for this show. I do, when it comes to this movie, the one thing I was curious about is this is a kitchen sink movie. This is very much and let's throw everything at the screen. I think of a movie that is not nearly as good, but was also a kitchen sink movie. Like Darren Aronofsky's Mother, which was again, just throw everything, cults and sex and motherhood and killing and just the world pulling itself apart. Was there ever a moment where you thought this is too much of a kitchen sink movie? Like what prevents it at some point from becoming just a mixtape of references?
Okay. I think there's two questions in there.
Okay.
There's the too much and there's also the mixtape element.
Sure.
I think the mixtape element, is solved by the fact that there are actual real emotions and feelings going on in the movie. And I think that those ground the movie. And then that in itself relates to why the too muchness I think works ultimately because it has something holding it down. You do keep returning to these moments. Again, not everyone is going to take to this movie. I can tell you immediately, my mom wouldn't enjoy this movie.
No, I don't think my mom's going to enjoy this movie. Even though I kind of think like if she could get over a few things, I actually think she would.
Look, I think,
as it's presented, I don't think so.
I think thematically, my mom, if like some of the mother-daughter stuff, I mean, my mom would be a mess, you know. And who knows, maybe I would be able to drag her every now and then. She saw and enjoyed Inception. So, you know, it's possible. Anything is possible.
Right.
I think this is a bit more extreme than Inception, but, you know, but I think that not every movie needs to be for everyone, first off. Okay. It's okay for people to not enjoy every movie. There's people I know who don't enjoy this movie and, you know, sure, I've cut them out of my life.
You're a vicious bastard.
No, but seriously, like it's fine, right? you know, I was concerned that the movie would be too much. I think it's possible that at moments, maybe it was, but I think that there was a feeling in the movie, both in terms of the emotion, the emotional center that I was talking about, but I think actually there's a combination of just the impeccable kind of technical craft of the movie. There's something in the way the movie is constructed at a let's say at a script and then I guess later on an editing level that always feels like there's some kind of a sure hand, right? It's a difficult quality in a movie to put your finger on. Like, it's a bit intangible, but it's real. And we know this in all kinds of movies where sometimes you watch a movie and you feel like you're in the wrong hands and you're like, I don't trust this.
Yeah.
And in this, there was something about it right from the opening frames where I was like, I trust it. I just trust it. And so even in the moments where I think maybe it might have in theory gone too far, I was still with it. Like, I didn't let it go.
It reminds me of when you see comedy constructed, like not just an act, not just a routine, but when you see like physical comedy. No, but when you see like, you know, when you see like kind of more classic comedy, this is yeah. Actually, the next thing I was going to say is this film actually feels quite singular, despite all the references and despite the fact that it's a timeline movie. This movie actually feels very, very much on its own, in its own little mm-hmm. space. Mm-hmm. What it reminds me of is when you see classic comedy constructed and what the comedian knows is too far. Like, on the surface, it yeah. looks like they're just pratfall after belly laugh after belly laugh. But in the end, there's actually a lot of science to it, you know, and you mm-hmm. know that you're in good, like, you can tell good comedy from bad comedy because the good comedy knows where the line is and where to stop and just how far they can push you before you're going to tune out. That's this movie. Is this movie, even though it's going to throw the kitchen sink at you, even though it's going to throw butt plugs and hot dog fingers and, you know, fanny packs as weapons, which, by the way,
when he went all Jackie Chan with that, like,
with a fanny pack. Yeah. Yeah. Like, well played.
Beautiful. Yeah.
That is when you know you are in good hands and you are in the hands of the Daniels know just how far they can push you before you're going to bend. And that I think is the line. I'm sure they had a lot of other ideas. I'm sure there were a lot of other timelines. I'm sure there were a lot of other movies. I'm sure there's all kinds of other things they thought about putting into this movie, but they're like, you know what?
I'm sure.
Let's keep it to this. It's still an awful lot. That is going to work. That's the machine.
I also found, you know, and again, like, you know, I always like addressing kind of criticisms of movies. I think one of the criticisms that I've seen from some people, I didn't have this problem with the movie, but I can see why some people would have it, is that there's certain jokes that feel like they get run into the ground. How many times do you see the hot dog fingers? And I can see how that would get less funny over time.
No, always funny.
For some people, the joke wore out. Okay. Now I will say if it wears out, it wears out, and maybe the movie doesn't work as well or whatever. But I think that part of the reason that the movie actually did work for me is exemplified by stuff like that. And even by some of that last act, like, we're going to hit every single note stuff. There is a way that the movie, I think, in an effort to both be too much, but also keep you sort of centered at all times in terms of, like, in certain cases, literally just understanding what's happening, even when you don't necessarily understand all the mechanics of what's happening, you kind of can follow what's happening. I think that what they've done a little bit is, like, leaned heavy on that sort of thing to just kind of, like, look, okay, we understand, like, there is a version of this movie where we don't have to come back to everything five times and yeah. where we don't need to, like, hit every note at the end to wrap everything up. And there's certain audiences that will get it. But if we do put this in there, maybe it makes for a slightly elongated movie. Maybe some jokes will feel like they're being hit one too many times if you didn't like them as much the first time or whatever. But the mechanics of the movie, it'll hold together.
It works better as a machine that way.
Yeah. And again, like, you know, there's an argument to be made. Well, you could, you know, stand to risk it, right? You could risk it more. But I think the movie is already risking so much that I don't begrudge the filmmakers here saying like, okay, look, there's only so far we're willing to go. Right. We can go this far in these directions, but actually we will keep things relatively grounded in other ways, even potentially to the detriment, right? But it's to the detriment, in my opinion, to the detriment in the way in which, you know, this is a movie that has so many parts. Mm-hmm. It has so many parts. And yet it exists as more than the sum of its parts somehow.
Yeah.
Which that's an impressive feat.
Well, I think that is your answer to how it becomes more than just a kitchen sink movie and how mm-hmm. it wasn't a mixtape of references is mm-hmm. it's all in the name of something bigger. You know, it's not just to see what they can get away with. It's not just to see which one person in the back of the audience they can make smile by some obscure reference to a Sonny Chiba right. movie. You know, it's like we are here for the catharsis. We are here yeah. for the love. We are here for that moment of being seen. That is what we're here for. Yeah, we're going to do some kooky stuff along the way, but it's all in service of the bagel.
When you're looking at filmmakers pushing things, mm-hmm. you know, as all of these filmmakers have done, and importantly, again, Wachowski's huge influence mm-hmm. on this movie.
Oh, sure.
Huge. Just like literally they have talked about how when they were conceiving of this movie, it was, what if my mom was in the Matrix, right? It's like this was their answer to that movie. And so it's interesting to me to think about, like, okay, what's an example of some filmmakers who are genuinely just like some of the most creative filmmakers around, who take the kinds of risks that the Wachowskis do, and how those risks work and how they pay off. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And when they do, it's spectacular. And sometimes they don't. And sometimes it's in the same movie.
Yeah.
And what's amazing to me in this, in Everything Everywhere, is that the Daniels have somehow, in my opinion, not quite matching the Matrix. Similarly to the Matrix, they've done a bunch of stuff. Like, I think back to like when Will Smith, you know, our dearly departed Academy member, Will Smith, you know, told the story of why he passed on starring in The Matrix. And he said that it was because he met with the Wachowskis and they were like giving him this speech about like, oh, and then you're going to do this. And then the camera's going to do this. And he was kind of like, I mean, you know, he was being charming about it in retrospect, but clearly what he was saying was, I don't understand what you're talking about, and I don't trust that you can necessarily deliver. Now, he was wrong,
right?
And he admits that he was wrong. But this strikes me as a similar case where, like, I imagine, like, the actors who signed up must have spoken to him. And they've talked about this. They're spoken to the Daniels. And they've talked – Michelle Yeoh has talked about this, that she spoke to them. And they described, it's like you read the script, you're like, I don't understand what's going on here. And then you talk to them and they describe it and you just feel like, okay, I'm putting myself in your hands. And they were right to trust them. They were right to trust these two young directors who like, I'm sorry, but this movie could have been a disaster.
Well, this movie could have gone horribly wrong. But I mean, that's it's this little ecosystem of trust, like from the top down, like from A24 to the Daniels to the actors, and this little, you know, this little ecosystem of trust that goes all the way around.
All the crew.
Yeah, everybody.
I mean, think about the Daniels hiring 7 people to do the visual effects for this very visual effects heavy movie.
Yeah. And saying that we're not going to burn you all out.
We're not going to burn you all out. We're going to let you get wild and creative and do things with the visual effects that because they're going to be cheap, we're going to find other ways to make them unique and charming. And you think about that and you go like, that's a lot of trust that they placed in those seven guys. I think they were all men. I don't know that they were all men, but I have a feeling they were all men. But the point,
it's not a bad bet.
But the point is like that to me, I mean, if you want to ask what like cinema is to me, it's a bunch of people who came together and all trusted each other to be able to do something and to see if they could pull it off. And then they put it on the screen and they trusted the audience to come in and watch it. And the audience trusted that, like, okay, these guys might be able to deliver something and I'm going to suspend my disbelief and go along with it. And like, you know, not everyone is going to be rewarded for that trust. People are going to have different reactions, but like, it's, I can't express to you enough. You know, I saw the movie at the TIFF secret screening on a Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Okay, that's pretty early to see a movie like this, and yet, I had my qualms. I had seen their previous movie, Swiss Army Man, and I liked it, but but as much as I liked it, I was like, I don't know if these guys have it. Like they kind of pulled it off there, but like, I don't know, there might be a limit to this kind of thing. So I wasn't totally trusting. Soraya, who I was seeing it with, was like actively not trusting in a certain way, but she still gave herself over. And when the movie was finished, like whatever, 2 hours and 20 minutes later or whatever it was, we felt so invigorated. And both of us were just, and you know, sorry to have gone off on the long Marvel jag, but it's like both of us felt this feeling that we hadn't felt in quite a while, even though we'd seen many movies that we really loved, and in some cases that I loved more than this movie. But there was something about this movie that made me feel like, right, movies. You know, I was like Vin Diesel, like the movies. You know, it's like this is what can happen when everyone in the process, from the people who make it to the people who watch it, and everyone in between, have place a kind of trust in something, in the power of a movie, of all things, a movie. Like, what is it? It's just a thing that you just go and watch it. Like, who cares? To move you, to excite you, to make you laugh, to you know, be thrilling, all of those things. To get you thinking about things in a real way, I mean, we've barely talked about the representational aspects of the movie, and we're probably not the people specifically to talk about it. Although, you know, I don't know if you're the child of immigrants, but I am, and there's things about it that connected with me on that level. Just all the connection points that a movie can have, this one has.
Yeah. I think, you know, to put a point on it, I think what is wonderful about that trust and what is wonderful about this movie is that it does it all so elegantly. Like, this movie should be an absolutely complicated, crazy ask. And yet it is so straightforward and simple, you know, even right down to the universe is a bagel and I'm about to destroy it. What I will say is what this reminds me of is way back when I first started writing, when I was still working in an office, there was somebody in the office who knew I love films and would ask me like, what should I watch? And they'd do everything. Like, they would hand me their cable guide. They would like point me towards the streaming thing, you know, or occasionally it was, I'm going to be going to this theater on this night. Here's what's playing. What should I watch? And I do remember specifically that there was one time and I was like, I said, do you trust me? This is going to be really weird, but I think you'll find it rewarding. And I sent this woman to see Synecdoche, New York. She didn't love it. She didn't hate it. I know, but she appreciated that experience and that story and how singular it was. This is very much like that. You know, if somebody, they may not know what they're getting into and they may balk. Thank you.
Beautiful story.
And they may balk. Like, that was the thing. Like, she, like, I kept getting her trust out of it. I was like, it's going to be weird, but it's not going to be a waste of your time. You know, I really think that this is a valuable use of your time. This is, this movie absolutely is a valuable use of everybody's time. And I think as many people should see it as possible. Listening back to that conversation with Corey, I'm reminded just how much we talk when you let us off the leash. I've known the gent for over 10 years, and it's always the same. I'm also taken in by how excited we both sound to be discussing all of this. Like two kids in a candy store, and neither one of us are able to believe the delights all around us. Finally, I must admit that it was hilarious to me to listen to myself try to explain the plot of this movie. That really wasn't a great summary, but I'm not sure I could have done any better now after seeing the movie another half dozen times. But there we go. That is the final postcard of Playing Favorites, and I'm really grateful that Corey was able to be a part of it. Come on back on Monday, May 6th, when I'll get back to our usual shenanigans with MatineeCast 325. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca. You can also find them on all of the usual places, Apple, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, you name it. Everything gives you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Everything Everywhere All at Once can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. On Twitter, I am matinee_ca, and there is Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. For Corey, I'm Ryan. Thanks for playing favorites with us today.